I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. The Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro start in just a few months in early August. The question being asked now, is Brazil ready for the Games? What with its president facing an impeachment trial, its economy in a downward slide, worries about water pollution, and the spread of the Zika virus that's been tied to birth defects. The World Health Organization has cautioned athletes and visitors to take precautions against Zika, but not for the Games to be postponed or canceled. Today, we discuss preparations for the Games and whether or not it's worth it for cities and for countries to host the Olympics. And later, we'll get the latest on Zika. Let me introduce our two guests. Dave Zirin, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. He's sports editor at The Nation, host of the podcast Edge of Sports, and his latest book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy has been reissued and updated. And Dave, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is David Goldblatt, author of the forthcoming book, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. He writes for The Guardian. He also reports for BBC Radio 4 and BBC World Service. And Dave Goldblatt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well, joining us from England.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Dave, let me begin with you. You were in Rio recently, described arriving at the airport that looked ready for the Olympics. You get into Rio and not so much. Is Rio ready for these games?
Rio is ready for the games for sure, but the question is at what price? I mean, I was able to tour the Olympic facilities, the new bus rapid transit line that takes you around Rio's notorious traffic straight from the airport. So in other words, Rio is ready for foreign consumption. The problem is what's happening in Rio itself. I heard stories of displacements, stories of police occupations of favelas, saw with my own eyes the upcoming militarization, and of course all of this is happening, as you mentioned, in a period of economic contraction, yet this money is already earmarked for the Olympics. So while the city itself cries for public infrastructure and cries for greater investments in health and education, that money is actually being cut, especially with the new unelected president, Michel Temer, replacing Dilma Rousseff, who was just impeached, which happened also while I was there. So it's a very roiling time. And so, yes, ready for the Olympics, but are the people of Rio ready for the Olympics? That's a different story.
And I'll pick up on that. David, this is a story we've heard before. We heard in Beijing. We heard in other cities that hosted the Olympics, which is the removal of residents, for instance, in certain areas to make room for some of these stadiums and playing fields. Are we sort of at the point of asking whether we need to have Olympics anymore in the scale that we do?
I think we've been asking that for some time. So when the cost of the Sochi Olympics alone comes in at $55 billion, more than all of the other Winter Olympics put together, I think we need to ask this question, you know, very, very strongly. $20 billion is the current estimate for Rio 2016. Athens came in probably at around $16 billion. Beijing at $40 billion. I mean, clearly this is just not a tenable way of organizing urban development or spending public money wisely. So there is a debate, but the International Olympic Committee have only reacted, you know, very partially to it through Agenda 2020, which is the raft of reforms passed under Thomas Bach, which have attempted to change the bidding model to encourage cheaper and less extravagant bids. But even then, I am unconvinced that really we will see any trimmer Olympics in the next decade.
A kind of edifice complex, you think, David Goldblatt?
Well, part of the problem is, you know, I wish that the arguments that were made in support of this kind of expenditure were true. I mean, if it were the case that the Olympics really did transform the sort of physical and sporting culture of a country and spread participation to groups who had not hitherto engaged in sport and generated infrastructure and enthusiasm and networks of coaches, to build that and produce a healthier and happier society, I would be, you know, it would be fantastic. But all of the evidence suggests that it is not true, that people are kidding themselves, and that coalitions of local political and economic coalitions, you know, who do make money out of these operations through the construction industry, the service industry, the security industry, continue to come up with rationales that actually, in terms of an equitable public policy, are just not sustainable or reasonable.
Well, Dave, let me go back to you. And I remember talking with you about the World Cup also in Rio. That was, 2 years ago. There were protests. There were some of the same questions being raised that we're talking about today on the show.
No, that's absolutely right. And it's worth looking at the last 3 years big picture to understand what's happening in Rio right now and where the political situation is. And this is the way I would characterize it from many interviews and a lot of ground research on this. Is 2013, during what's called the Confederations Cup, which was the warm-up to the World Cup, right, Brazil had its largest demonstration since the fall of the dictatorship 30 years earlier. And the symbol for those demonstrations, the target of them, were these new stadiums that were being built across the country for the World Cup. Unnecessary stadiums, unnecessary public expenditures. And I think it's fair to classify those 2013 demonstrations as being not left-wing or right-wing, but just an explosion of anger by people frustrated at the direction of the country. 2014, the World Cup happens with relatively little protest because the streets, I saw this firsthand, were hyper-militarized, frighteningly militarized for an ostensible democracy. And then that year, you had a very contested election where Dilma Rousseff of the Workers' Party barely won. Fast forward to 2016, you have a huge economic contraction in the country, and you have that anger in these demonstrations now had this past year a decidedly right-wing character of hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, people marching with their nannies, pushing their children alongside mm-hmm. them while they walked their pure breed dogs, calling for the Labor Party to leave. And now what you have is someone in power in Michel. You have an exhausted population, first of all. You have a Workers' Party base of people who are not exactly in the mood to protest. I mean, just exhausted by the corruption, the betrayals, everything. And you have someone in power now, Michel Temer, who, if an election was held today, only 2% of the country would vote for. 60% of Brazil has already said that they want this new president impeached, who's only been in power about a week. And he is right now running, not running on this because he's not running for election, but he's trying to push through reforms that actually shrink the healthcare budget. Think about that. As they're trying to control the Zika virus, he's calling for a series of cuts in public health. And so it's got the country politically just in an absolute knot of people not knowing where to turn, how to protest, who to even push to make the kind of changes that are needed to make sure that Brazil has a safe infrastructure for the people of Brazil and not just for foreign tourists.
Well, David, let me go back to you. And a couple of things that Dave said I want to pick up on. One is it often seems that when a city hosts the Olympics, it creates a kind of city within a city for the games and for the events. And I'm wondering as well, since September 11th, whether the security concerns have turned into a police state in certain places and how these two things get played out in a host city.
I mean, security concerns at the Olympics have been getting more and more acute since at least 1972. When, of course, you have the Black September kidnapping in the Olympic Village. So 9/11 certainly changes the game and amps it up. But we've been heading in this direction for quite a long time. And Brazil seems to be peaking with 85,000 security personnel currently deputed at the moment to service the security needs of the games, which just, you know, that's more than at Sochi in 2014, which seems completely extraordinary. I mean, part of the problem here is, you know, what kind of infrastructure you're building and what kind of post-games, use for it you imagine. I mean, so much of the stuff that's been built, say, particularly Olympic villages, which one might imagine, you know, might open the games up to the city and blend in and be part of it, you know, often envisaged as relatively fortified or gated communities to be sold on, not as social housing, but afterwards to the wealthy. I mean, certainly that's what happened in Vancouver 2010 with the the Olympic Village, and it's certainly what's going to happen in Rio 2016. So these things have got a kind of gated city vision built into them from the very beginning. And this is a great shame, because it seems to me one of the fantastic things that an Olympics does offer is the opportunity to spread a mega event truly across the city, you know, and engage a wider public who can't necessarily get the tickets. And let's face it, not everyone can get a ticket to the Olympics, whatever. And so some of the great successes of, you know, the London 2012 Games, you know, were the cycling races done on the roads, which attracted just enormous and incredibly enthusiastic crowds. And there's the Olympics actually out in a city, shaping it in a kind of positive way. And that's a real shame. But once again, you know, the bureaucrats, the security chiefs, and the IOC's overwhelming concerns are not with the wider public of the city that hosts games, but with you know, its political coalition that it deals with, and its television people and its sponsors. So no wonder.
Dave, let me pick up on something. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Yeah, Dave. And I've got a Dave and a David. I just figured that out.
Just as well. Imagine if you had two Davids. Then we'd really be in trouble.
I'm sorry. I don't know why. I just figured out I have a Dave and a David. Nonetheless, let me go back to you, Dave Zirin. And David Goldblatt talked about something like 85,000 security mm-hmm. people in Rio. Is that because of fear of terrorism or fear of people in Rio protesting the games?
Well, this is the problem in the post 9/11 calculus when they host these mega events. Any city hosts these mega events. What happens is they have this mandate because of the post 9/11 world, because of the world on the global war on terror, being able to say that the Olympics are a high valued target. And yet the kind of security we see is often much more of a grassroots policing of the local population. I'll never forget being in a meeting at London, in London, in the lead up to the 2012 games, and it was a press conference where they were showing off the new cameras that were going, these infrared high-powered cameras that were going to be up on streetlights to be able to track terrorist activity for the Olympics, and it would keep London safe. And someone asked the legal person who was heading this up, saying like, well, what happens after the Olympics? What happens to these cameras? And he said, well, it's not like we can put them back in the box, can we? In other words, the cameras stay even after the terror threat goes. And that's part of why it's good to think of these events as Trojan horses, because it allows people to accept things like this hypersecurity or like the public funding of these ridiculous white elephant projects that people would otherwise reject and protest. Yet because it becomes wrapped in hosting the Olympics or the World Cup, it becomes accepted by the populace. But then, not unlike executive power in the United States, it's very difficult to roll that back. It's very difficult to put the wine back in the bottle.
We're going to take a very short
Can I
break.
Just add to that?
You know
Can
what, Dave? David, hold on. Only because we have to take a very short break, and then we will get
no
back
problem.
To our conversation, talking about Brazil and the Olympics. Talking with Dave Zirin and David Goldblatt, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at whyy Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro this summer, the future of the Olympics as well. And again, our guests are David Goldblatt. He's got a book coming out called The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. He writes for The Guardian, reports for BBC Radio 4, and also for BBC World Service. Also with us, Dave Zirin. He's sports editor at The Nation, and he's got a couple of podcasts, including Edge of Sports. And his latest book, Brazil's Dance with the Devil, has been updated and includes information about the Olympics. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. David Goldblatt, I know you wanted to say something right before the break. Go ahead.
Well, it's the model of the Trojan horse that Dave was talking about. I think that's also true of planning regulations and getting things built. And in Brazil, one of the kind of most gigantic projects in Rio is in the port area, which, you know, a huge swathe of the old docks of Rio has been completely rebuilt along the lines of most conventional waterside, you know, super business orientated developments like Canary Wharf. And the Olympics, you know, there's actually the only Olympic stuff that's there is a tiny little media village and an operations center in a site of otherwise thousands of acres. And the Olympics becomes a way of bypassing all forms of public consultation, normal planning regulations, you know, and directing public funds into essentially giant private real estate projects.
Hmm. You know, Dave, and I have to say, I enjoy watching the Olympics. I think like millions and perhaps billions of people do. And I'm sitting here listening to the two of you talk, and I'm feeling really depressed about what's going to happen in Rio and concerned that there are, if not human rights abuses, certainly questions of problems associated with hosting the Olympics. How is then someone supposed to watch this stuff? How are we supposed to think about it?
Well, first of all, I think people can watch the Olympics in the evening and perhaps protest at their Brazilian consulate during the day in solidarity with the people in Rio who will be protesting against what are very real human rights abuses. That's one way to approach it. And I would say that I agree with you. Like, I think that, you know, in our high-carb, very monochromatic diet of sports that we get in this country, which is usually football and things that have to do with football, and David, that would be American football,
exactly,
of the more brain-damaged variety. I think that it is one of those opportunities to not only enjoy different kinds of sports, but also to actually get a full realization of female athletes, which you don't get typically yet, which the Olympics provide. What I would love to see is what I like to think of as the Olympics a la carte, which is, can we get the Olympics without the debt, militarization of public space, and displacement? And we could do that if we were willing to have the Olympics on a very static series of rotating sites and treat it, as David said, as the television production that frankly it is, and stop pretending that it's a substitute for urban development.
Well, David Goldblatt, let me go back to you and go back to your book where you write about the history of the Games. And I mean, it is inspiring, and reading about what happened in Berlin and what Jesse Owens, you know, did on the field as Adolf Hitler watched, these moments where you feel like this is what real athletes can do in a political sense. The rise of the Paralympics after World War II. I mean, it seems there are things to celebrate here.
Well, unquestionably, I mean, the whole point, you know, why we're still hanging in with the Olympics despite this extraordinarily terrible record over the last 30 or 40 years with preposterous forms of urban development, is that it offers a celebration of cosmopolitan humanity. And in a globalized world, we're really short of those. And in that regard, I'm kind of quite conservative in the sense that, you know, it's easy to take things apart, but it's really difficult to build new things. And, you know, the Olympics and that legacy of the challenges to the ruling bodily, racial and gender order that it offers through athletics is an extraordinary and continues to be an inspiring and amazing spectacle. And that is great. That is really important. And we lose that at our peril. It's worth remembering, though, that, you know, when de Coubertin first cooked his reinvention of the modern Olympics up, that was not what it was meant to be. I mean, the ideological roots of the Olympics as a spectacle are what de Coubertin called a display of manly virtues in which the rest of us would quietly and politely applaud the gentlemen athletes and amateurs of the global north in the late 19th century for our own moral edification. And the idea that women or people of color or people who were different, ably bodied or people of a different social class had something to contribute was actually complete anathema to the people who invented the Olympics and the model of sport that they had. And what's so amazing about the history of the Games is seeing people take that on and challenge it. And, you know, those things continue. And that's why one of the reasons I kind of keep faith with the Olympic Games. I mean, I think the rotating idea that Dave talked about is good. I think, you know, do we need as many sports? I mean, really, what is football doing at the Olympics? Women's football, I understand. But to be honest, it's like we have the World Cups. So, you know, maybe we need to start thinking about trimming the scale and the size of what we do, as well as the way in which it is staged.
Why is golf at the Olympics this year? I mean, this is mind-boggling.
Top of the list, man. And, of course.
Well, what's your problem, Dave? What's your problem with golf? Yeah, no, go ahead.
Well, I can. It's not merely rhetorical. So it's like, why is golf at the Olympics? Because golf is about land acquisition. And it's any of these sports, most of them you can do inside an arena in the Olympic Park. Yet golf requires land seizure. And this is what makes golf valuable internationally. And also, golf goes in with IMF World Bank precepts of turning your city into a global tourist base. So they're able to do these reforms to create world-class golf courses and say, you see, this goes with our perspective about, once again, about turning Rio into a place for foreign consumption. But if I could tell, just read one really quick story that speaks to just the way the language of the – and how aware the IOC and Olympic committees are of some of the critiques that David and I have been raising. I did a tour of Olympic Park, and I was in one of the facilities, and it was built in this very blocky type structure. It was pretty, but different. And I asked about that, and they said, oh, it's like big pieces of Lego, and what we're going to do is take it apart, and then we're taking it into these poor communities, and it's going to become schools. Now, I don't know how true that is, but it's a hell of a PR gambit to say that this stadium that no one needs can be taken apart piece by piece like an erector set and then turned into a school in a poor area.
David Goldblatt, we have an email from Daniel. He says, at some point, a host city will bite off more than it can chew and the games will fail. Will this be the year? I mean, I think we'll find out whether it is or isn't. But can you imagine going forward, the Olympic Committee puts out the bids and no city makes the bid? I mean, are we close to something like that?
We're getting reasonably close to that. I mean, at the Winter Olympics for 2022, we were down to Beijing, a city with no mountains, and Almaty, the capital of Kazakhstan, certainly a city in Kazakhstan, you know, whose human rights records is, you know, not good. Right. So you were down to two, five cities, including Oslo, who were really pretty serious about it, all decided to pass. I mean, it's that's encouraged and, you know, required the IOC to reform. And certainly for the 2024 Summer Games, the sort of smaller demands of the IOC have at least encouraged four reasonable bidders, of which Los Angeles is the leading American bid, and along with Paris, probably the favorite. So we may, it's hard, you know, it's in the balance. I mean, we'll see. Los Angeles is proposing, you know, not merely to break even, but to actually turn a profit on an overall expenditure of around $5.5 billion, which is an incredibly reduced games, and given the record of 1984, not entirely implausible.
Oh,
so we will see, but it seems to me, even if we do manage to reduce the overall cost, we need to be asking, you know, how can we wisely spend it in a way that really does benefit a city as well as generating a spectacle?
Let me reintroduce the two of you. That's David Goldblatt. He's got a forthcoming book called The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. Dave Zirin with us as well, sports editor at The Nation. And we are talking about the upcoming Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil this summer, and about some of the past games as well, and raising the question about the future of the games. 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to join the conversation. We got emails at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Rick from Warminster to join us. Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I had the benefit of working the Atlanta Olympics from 93 to 96.
Huh?
I was the director of press operations and public information. And you get a real insight because you have so many players. The organizing committee begins it. A year later, here comes the NOC, National Olympic Committee. And then the third year, the IOC comes in. And it's kind of like a murder in a small mother town. The FBI comes in and says, we'll take it from here. But it was an insight of a $2 billion operation. You raise it by tickets and T-shirts. You raise it by corporate sponsorship. And then finally, you get it on the sponsors. But what was of interest was that the city itself is often affected, such as public safety that you've mentioned. Also, the idea of all the people coming in from around the world. And then, of course, you have the athletes. So there's a perspective from four different levels. And I think what was interesting was when Price Waterhouse comes at the end of the games It is considered a nonprofit operation, and the profit was $1 to the Atlantic Committee of the Olympic Games.
They made a dollar.
So it was an interesting insight to it, and I think the athletes continue to benefit from it, and in the inspirational way that's been described by the book author. But I think also what has changed that it becomes now a political platform for the world to view.
Well,
my opinion.
No, Rick, I appreciate your opinion. Let me give Dave Zirin. Yeah, Dave Zirin, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, that's very important for Rio because of what just happened there. I mean, a president who was elected 18 months ago, not even 18 months ago, with 54 million votes was just deposed from power by a Congress, three-fifths of whom are being investigated for crimes far worse than anything she actually did. I mean, it's being described internationally as a kind of judicial or legislative coup, as well as by Dilma Rousseff herself, the person who was deposed. And so what we could see with this Olympics is a kind of grotesque kabuki theater where the new unelected president pushing through this unelected, very unpopular, quote-unquote, mandate is going to be feted by world leaders, even if he doesn't actually himself make a public appearance, because a story came out yesterday that he was probably going to be in private greeting the leaders of the world and getting all of their praise and making all sorts of deals, yet fear that if he so much as stepped out of his private box, he would be cascaded with boos for an international audience.
David Golbet, we have an email from YR, says, even before Zika, the water pollution is a major issue. Last report is that it's still filthy. And I'm thinking also about the Beijing Olympics and the worry about the air pollution there. I mean, this seems to come not with all cities, but certainly there are questions about, I guess, the long-distance swimmers and if they can help safely swim in the waters of Rio.
Yeah, but there's a real issue here. And, I mean, again, this is one of the tragedies of the Rio Games. Is part of the bid, part of the reason that Rio won is that, you know, there was an enormous infrastructure plan to clean up Rio's bays, lagoons and rivers and deal with the fact that about 50% of Rio's sewage just goes straight into it untreated. As with many aspects, the transport area included, especially in expenditure that would benefit the wider public in Rio rather than just very narrow groups, all of that expenditure has been lost. And so we have, you know, the sort of ludicrous situation where the main response to the pollution in Rio's lagoons is that there will be eco boats towing, you know, barriers to make sure that the dead dogs and the sofas that occasionally float across the bay don't interfere. And this is not hyperbole. I mean, Brazilian sailors who've been training regularly have encountered corpses and sofas in Guanabara Bay. And while the IOC and the Rio organizers say quite rightly that levels of fecal bacteria are are within permissible limits, mainly because, you know, salt water and sun kill them off, what they are not engaging with is the level of fecal viruses. And Associated Press, bless them, commissioned some serious scientific research a couple of months ago and compared the level of fecal viruses in the water to that of the Southern Californian permissible safe levels, and found that in Rio they're 17 million times higher.
My jaw just dropped. I mean, I'm just trying to digest it.
Yeah,
everything
I don't
you just
know
said
those.
There.
I got to say, I don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but my nose agrees with David because I was out on the bay. I did photos and video. I took it's kind of a surreptitious thing for journalists that we do is we because they don't want journalists sniffing around the water, but there are these kinds of tourist schooners or schooners, if you will, that go around Rio so you can get a 360-degree view of what is one of the most beautiful cities on the planet. Yet if you don't look at the beautiful coastlines and mountains and instead look straight down into the water, you do see floating dead animals. I saw with my own eyes the thing that was scariest to me was we were in the Olympic waters and I saw a floating open can of oil, like one of those mammoth barrels of oil with open, slightly leaking oil into the water. It's a very dangerous situation for open air swimming, and a danger. And there's an athlete's rights issue. I mean, Olympic athletes are the least organized, least unionized, least powerful athletes on the planet relative to the amount of coin that they produce. And if they did have some sort of collective voice, I have no doubt that they would be raising the question of what could happen to them physically by swimming in these waters.
Well, a couple of minutes. Hopefully we haven't chased all our listeners away here. But just a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, and we've got another guest who will be joining us. But so all that aside, David Goldblatt, are there games, are there athletes that you have a particular interest in Rio? a weird segue there, but
I'm really feeling for the triathletes. I mean, it's one thing to sail in those waters, but open air swimming in it strikes me as just extraordinarily ghastly. And it's those guys I've been reading, you know, people, and I think Dave, it's so right what Dave said about, you know, there's no voice for athletes. I mean, people are given the impossible choice of, you know,
right.
Are we going to go and try and do it with mouthwash at the last moment and hope, or are we going to go there 3 months early and see if we can get sick enough for long enough that we get the immunity that Rio's own poor citizens have to endure? And I think this is just an awful thing to have to ask athletes to do.
Dave, about 30 seconds before I have to say goodbye to both of you, any last words for our listeners?
Yeah, first, I mean, it's an odd thing to say, but the person I'm on with, David Goldblatt, he is just a delightful writer. I want to recommend that people get his book and read about what he writes.
It's a
never-ending education to read David Goldblatt. And if there's something I'm interested in, I mean, look, I'm talking to you from the Baltimore, Maryland region here, and we got old man Michael Phelps going in for one more Olympics. So, yeah, I am curious. I want to see what Michael Phelps does. I want to see what old man Usain Bolt does.
Man Olympics.
Yeah. So as I get older, that's more where my proclivities lie. And so you know, back pain plus golds are a beautiful thing.
Well, we're going to have the two of you back on Radio Times talking more about the Olympics. My thanks to you, Dave Zirin, once again for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sports editor at The Nation. And David Goldblatt, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. A forthcoming book, The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. We'll be talking about Zika after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The World Health Organization has cautioned athletes and visitors to Rio this summer for the Olympics to take precautions against Zika. The CDC has told pregnant women to avoid travel to the Olympics because of Zika fears. We asked Peter Hotez to join us once again. He's the founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at Baylor College of Medicine, where he's also the Texas Children's Hospital Endowed Chair of Tropical Pediatrics. And Peter Hotez, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So should the IOC suspend, delay, shut down the Summer Olympics because of Zika?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about that. I actually have a somewhat idiosyncratic or differing point of view, and it's based on the fact that if you look at what's going to be happening in Rio in August over the summer, that's going to be the cool and dry season in Rio de Janeiro. That's point one. So the mosquito numbers are going to be lower. This is a virus that's transmitted by the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes will not be out in full force at that time. You also have a situation where the virus has been in Rio de Janeiro for at least a year, so that a significant percentage of the population is now immunized against the virus because they've been infected and they've recovered. And the third is the fact that if the Brazilians are smart, and I think they are, they're aggressively spraying. So when you combine all those three factors, I actually think the risk of contracting Zika in Rio de Janeiro is going to be relatively low compared to many other parts of the Western Hemisphere. So I you know, there are some that are calling for postponing the games or getting rid of the games altogether. I'm not of that view.
And I want to talk about what might be happening here in the United States. But let's say someone is going to Rio, or perhaps even the parts of the world where in the summer it's cool. Bug spray, long sleeves. I mean, there's some basic precautions if people decide to go, let's say, to Rio this summer.
Sure, absolutely. And bug spray, using DEET especially. Bed nets probably won't have much of a role because these mosquitoes are often daytime feeders. But then staying in quality hotels that are aggressively spraying as well, those things are also going to be important. But you know, looking at other parts of the Western Hemisphere where this virus is ripping through right now, such as in the Caribbean islands and in Haiti and Puerto Rico, and maybe even the Gulf Coast, Rio actually may be safer than some of those areas.
Well, that's interesting. We spoke a few months ago. So what more do we know or have we learned about the Zika virus, this mosquito, in the last couple of months? Anything?
Yeah, we're in a steep learning curve. I think we're learning the full horror of this virus when it infects pregnant women. We're finding this virus can infect the neural progenitor cells. Those are the stem cells that give rise to the brain and stop the development of the brain. So everyone's talking about microcephaly having a small head size. Well, the reason there's a small head size is because the brain hasn't grown in the growing fetus, so the brain has stopped growing. And with it, there's been reduction in hydrostatic pressure in the cranial cavity, and then the skull collapses in on that. So it's a very tragic sequence of events, what some are calling fetal brain disruption sequence, where the brain stops developing in the fetus. So this is every mother's, every parent's nightmare, a virus that's been very aggressively spreading in communities and then causing the absence of the brain to develop.
And is that specifically, let's say, in a first or second trimester pregnancy, or let's say a woman gets bitten by Zika, but she's not pregnant at the time, she gets pregnant 6 months later, is she still at risk? Do we know?
So with your first question, it's probably happening early in pregnancy, first and second trimester. We don't know how late in the pregnancy the infection can occur for microcephaly to happen. We also don't know the frequency with which microcephaly happens. So that if in the studies coming out of French Polynesia, which is the place where the virus caused an epidemic right before it entered Brazil, it was estimated that only 1 in 100 mothers who were infected with Zika gave birth to a baby with microcephaly. But the numbers coming out of Brazil in much smaller series suggest it could be as high as 1 in 6. So
wow.
That's an important question. Is it 1 in 100, 1 in a, or 1 in 6? That's a big difference. In terms of the virus lingering, it looks as though that does not happen very commonly, so that most of the time when you get infected, if you're a non-pregnant adult who gets infected with Zika, it's like getting dengue or other arboviruses, other viruses transmitted by mosquitoes, where you'll have the virus in your blood for 5 to 7 days, then you develop an antibody response, and then the virus is gone, and then you're immunized. So if Zika plays by the same playbook as dengue or some of the others, then that probably happens as well.
I mean, like getting the flu, for instance?
Yeah, and then developing an antibody response. Now, we have seen that if a male is infected with Zika, the virus, during that period when the virus is in the blood, it's getting into other bodily fluids. And we've seen a few cases of the male transmitting the virus sexually to his female partner. I tend to think those are relatively infrequent cases. That does not happen very often. I think, but we don't know for sure because the scientific community is playing catch-up, trying to understand the full extent of this virus. But right now, it looks as though most of the cases are a result of mosquito bites from the Aedes aegypti mosquito.
Is there a connection between Zika and Guillain-Barré syndrome?
Yes, there appears to be. So what happens is if you're an adult and you get infected with Zika virus, a small percentage will go on to develop what appears to be an autoimmune response against the virus, which results in Guillain-Barré syndrome, which oftentimes is a condition that affects the peripheral nerves and can cause tingling sensations, but it can in some cases proceed to paralysis. We don't know how often that occurs. From French Polynesia, the numbers are 1 in 1,000,
but in Brazil it seems to be higher. So it seems to be a relatively uncommon complication, but it does occur. But overwhelmingly, this is a disease where you have to worry about infection during pregnancy.
Well, we're getting an update on the Zika virus with our guest, Dr. Peter Hotez, and again, founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. He's got many things that he does related to Zika and other conditions. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So while it might be cool and kind of winter in Rio de Janeiro this summer, it is summer here in the United States. And you had mentioned along the coast and perhaps parts of Florida, are we seeing Zika moving into the United States?
Well, that's what we're worried about happening. You know, the Gulf Coast has all of the Gulf Coast of the United States has all of the factors that suggest to us that it's susceptible to Zika. We have, first and foremost, the presence of the Aedes aegypti mosquito on the Gulf Coast, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, Mississippi, Alabama. Number one. Number two, we have the crowding. So this is an urban mosquito that's adapted to human habitats. And thirdly, there's a third factor that not many people appreciate is an extreme level of poverty. So poverty is an important risk factor for reasons that we can talk about where people are more exposed to mosquito bites.
And is that because
for all those reasons, I think the Gulf Coast is probably the area at greater risk right now in terms of the continental United States.
And you mentioned poverty. Is that because people can't afford screens on their windows, for instance?
That's right. Can't afford screens, but also you have a lot of garbage strewn about houses in poor neighborhoods. People do dumping of discarded tires. You also have a situation where you have standing water in plastic containers, and so all of those factors are linked to the increased risk of exposure of people living in extreme poverty.
Now, apparently, Puerto Rico has a lot of Zika. What can you tell us about that?
Well, Puerto Rico is like other Caribbean islands, is at high risk. The virus is rampaging through at a pretty rapid clip. One of the things we've seen in island populations, like in Micronesia, French Polynesia, most of the population could be infected within a few-week period of time. And it looks like that's happening in Puerto Rico as well, disproportionately affecting, again, people most likely living in poverty because of their increasing exposure to mosquito bites. We've already had our first microcephaly case in Puerto Rico, and we expect to see a lot more. So that's extremely tragic given all the difficulties that Puerto Rico has suffered lately in terms of economic downturns and problems with its debt. This is just another pile on.
Yeah.
And then, of course, on the Gulf Coast, now we're bracing for Zika as well.
Well, you mentioned the Gulf Coast, and I think eventually spring will come to Philadelphia. It's been rather chilly. But as the weather gets warmer and more humid and, you know, stays in the 90s and sometimes drifts into the 100s in parts of the country, do you imagine then this Zika, this mosquito and this Zika virus then migrating north?
Well, we don't know for sure because And there's a couple of reasons. One, most of the infections seem to be transmitted by Aedes aegypti, which is uniquely adapted to humans. Mm-hmm. We do not know the extent right now currently that Aedes aegypti is in Philadelphia. Historically, it's been a problem. So in the founding of our nation in the late 1700s, Philadelphia has experienced dengue and yellow fever epidemics.
Absolutely.
Which are transmitted by Aedes aegypti. But whether Aedes aegypti is still present is not really that well studied, so that's a big unknown. There is a second Aedes species that can transmit Zika called Aedes albopictus that is in the Philadelphia area, but that mosquito is much less efficient at transmitting Zika than Aedes aegypti because it feeds on other mammals and other birds. So my overall assessment is that the risk of the mid-Atlantic region of the United States to Zika is pretty low, certainly much lower than the Gulf Coast.
It is. Just picking up on what you just said, it is when you read about this, it's easy to feel anxious about it. And it sounds like you're saying be vigilant, but we don't have to panic. Or do we? Maybe.
Well, you don't have to panic. Easier said than done. If you're a woman who's just learned that you're pregnant,
exactly.
It's a scary time for you. And I've been spending a fair amount of time talking to women who've recently found out they've become pregnant, and you try to allay their concerns and tell them to wear DEET. But right now, the one reassuring message is right now there is no Zika transmission in the continental United States. But this is fluid. This is a moving target. So we have to listen very closely to public service messages, listen to your physician, and look out for the way the media is all over this right now. If we do uncover evidence of Zika transmission, you'll know about it soon enough.
Let me get Eric from Springfield to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This kind of touches on what you were just speaking to, but okay, so let's say I go to Rio as a male. I get bit. I get Zika. We know I could transfer it through bodily fluids. So if I come back to the Philadelphia area in the middle of summer, and I get bit by a mosquito, could I introduce it into the mosquito population?
Could he, Peter?
In theory, yes. So, and in fact, that's presumably how, if we were to start seeing Zika transmission in the continental United States, that's how it would happen. Somebody coming in from an infected area, whether it's Brazil or in the Caribbean or in Central America, coming into the United States, and then as the Aedes aegypti mosquito numbers start going up, especially on the Gulf Coast, there's a chance that one of those mosquitoes will bite somebody that has Zika in their bloodstream, and that then could ignite transmission. And that's how it's been spreading from Brazil into Colombia, and then into Central America, and then into the Caribbean, and how we might see it happen on the Gulf Coast, as opposed to actually getting transport of mosquitoes infected with Zika into the region, which is another remote possibility, but most likely it's going to come in through people.
Eric, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Peter Hotez, you mentioned yellow fever in Philadelphia a couple of centuries ago. So what happens? I mean, what do you imagine is the course of this virus going forward?
What we know is from what happened when Zika's gotten introduced into places like Micronesia, French Polynesia, now Puerto Rico, and in northeastern Brazil, in areas where you have people who are exposed to mosquito bites, you get very high rates of infection, so that this virus quickly infects high percentages of the population. And in vulnerable areas where you have the Aedes aegypti mosquito, like on the Gulf Coast, my concern is that that could happen there as well.
So the response is a public health response, working on some kind of a drug that could block Zika, for instance?
Well, you know, things don't work that quickly with drugs or vaccines.
No.
So, and for reasons we can talk about, there will not be a vaccine in time for this epidemic. So right now, our only recourse is to go through old-fashioned Aedes aegypti control methods, which we know work, because the 18 Latin American countries were able to eradicate Aedes aegypti mosquitoes back in the 1960s. But the problem is it's not easily done. It's very labor-intensive because it's not just sending a truck around, sending up a mist of insecticide. That does not work for this particular species of mosquitoes. You have to go house to house, remove any standing water in containers, and then provide window screens, and then do insecticidal spraying in and around the house. So it's fairly labor-intensive, and one of the things we've learned is that the United States does not have a good track record of doing this. We've traditionally refused to conduct Aedes aegypti control on the Gulf Coast, in part because of cultural norms of privacy. In fact, it's labor-intensive and relatively pricey compared to controlling other mosquitoes. So that as a result, we've had Aedes aegypti on the Gulf Coast at least since the 1930s and probably much longer.
Well, I should add, and we are out of time here, Peter Hotez, Senate has passed some money, not as much as the president wants, for Zika, and we will see what happens there. Thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. That's Peter Hotez giving us an update on Zika. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.